Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. For the first time in a while, Americans are getting updates on the government's response to the pandemic straight from the government.
It's important to send the message to the public that the White House respects and will follow the science, and the scientists will speak independently, and that our core values of science, public health, and equity are going to drive our actions here at the White House.
That is Andy Slavitt, a senior advisor to President Biden's COVID-19 response team, which held its first virtual briefing yesterday. The team discussed a number of issues, including vaccination distribution and strategies to slow down the fast-spreading variants in the United States. Let's bring in Tom Frieden, former director of the CDC under President Obama, now CEO of Resolve to Save Lives. Dr. Frieden, welcome back.
Great to speak with you, Peter.
I want to start with the optics of yesterday's briefing. There were many qualified, high-ranking officials there talking about the government's response to the pandemic. What did that say to you?
Fundamentally, science is back, and that's crucially important because what we've been lacking for the past year is an organized response based on science that communicates forthrightly in real time with the public. And that is what we're seeing from the Biden administration. So it's very encouraging.
Well, the job ahead is still huge. Andy Slavitt, who we just heard at the top there, said it will be months before everyone who wants a vaccine will be able to get one. And he also says the two factors playing into that are that vaccine supply is not strong and not enough people are there to administer them. How do you improve both of those problems simultaneously?
The harder problem really is the supply problem. And one of the things we've heard from the new administration is that even they don't have clear information on when vaccines are going to be delivered from each of the manufacturers. And without that, it's very hard to plan. We know there aren't enough vaccines. We also know that too many vaccines are sitting in freezers instead of being injected into arms. And the latter problem, I think, will get improved with time as we figure out, for example, how to reallocate some doses that were given to chain pharmacies for nursing homes but aren't being used there and are sitting in freezers. And as we think through the logistics of, do you use all of your vaccine now because you have more coming so you can anticipate not needing to change the schedule for the next dose in 3 or 4 weeks, or do you hold back some amount for those second doses? We're not talking about changing the dose schedule, just the logistics of, do you keep those in the freezer for 3 or 4 weeks, or do you inject them anticipating you'll have more supply in the coming weeks? And without knowing what that supply will be, that's really an impossible decision to make rationally.
So have you seen any improvement or a plan from the federal government that would help improve that situation?
What we've seen is a commitment of this administration to tell governors in advance how much they're getting. And they've apparently done that with a 16% increase. And that's a good first step. But it's really not up to the administration. The companies need to be very clear on what they can deliver and when. And in the past, companies have often over-promised or just been overly optimistic about what they can do. The other issue is that we have to look at not just how many people are getting vaccinated, but who. First off, are we reaching nursing home residents and nursing home staff? We're hearing a lot of hesitancy among the staff of nursing homes, and that's problematic because that's nearly 40% of deaths among the residents of nursing homes. And if the staff aren't vaccinated, the risk to residents is much higher. Second, what's the denominator? What proportion of the different priority groups are we reaching? And third, what are we doing to address equity issues? If you just use a first-come, first-serve approach, you make inequality worse. You have to reach out to communities that may have less access or less trust in vaccines or the healthcare system.
I just have about 30 seconds left here, but as the former head of the CDC, what advice do you have for Dr. Rochelle Walensky as she inherits this institution that was frankly marred by politics under the past administration?
Well, she's off to a great start. Listen to staff, listen to the science, understand what went wrong and fix it, and identify the things that are going well and build them up, and remember that our safety and security in this country is inextricably interwoven with global health security and with the ability of countries all over the world to find, stop, and prevent the spread of health threats, COVID and the next one as well.
Former CDC Director Tom Frieden, thank you very much.
Thank you.
When President Biden stopped new enrollments in the Remain in Mexico policy last week, Univision journalist Leon Krause immediately thought about his visit to a campsite in Tijuana, where thousands of asylum seekers were waiting for their cases to make their way to the U.S. courts.
People living on their makeshift huts made by branches and twigs and blankets thrown over them, no access to sanitary facilities, and people who described extortion, kidnapping, sexual assault, sexual slavery, and that is just completely appalling.
The Remain in Mexico policy is just one of several controversial rules paused by the Biden administration in order to give the Department of Homeland Security some breathing room to fully review our country's immigration policies. Leon Krause and I spoke recently about what's next for the Remain in Mexico policy and some of the roadblocks the Biden administration is already facing. I asked Leon what happens to the current asylum seekers waiting in Mexico.
As you described, the Remain in Mexico program has indeed been one of the most controversial, but also one of the most successful decisions that the Trump administration took when it comes to immigration. And it essentially sent around 60,000 would-be refugees, mostly from Central America, but not only from Central America, to wait out their asylum requests in Mexico, a process that, given the gigantic immigration court backlog in the United States, I mean, was bound to take months or even longer. This has been really a humanitarian disaster that the Biden administration is now trying to change through a recent decision, but it won't be easy.
I mean, you laid out for us what you've seen with your own eyes. What is Mexico's stance on all of this?
The Mexican government has failed completely in guaranteeing any sort of basic security or shelter for these people. It decided to collaborate fully with Trump's most cruel policies. The amount of money that the Mexican government invests in, for example, its refugee agency named COMAR, is just $5 million a year, millions with an M, to help tens of thousands of immigrants and hundreds of thousands of displaced Mexicans. Just to give you a quick idea, in the United States, ICE has a budget of $8.3 billion with a B. So just compare the two.
Mm-hmm. This program ultimately, though, was designed to deter immigration and stop illegal immigration. Has this Remain in Mexico program actually done what it said it was going to do?
No. Immigration from Central America will not end soon. This program hasn't put an end to it. And the Biden administration has said that it is prepared to invest $4 billion over the next 4 years in the development of the Northern Triangle in Central America and Southern Mexico as well. And that's the only way to really change the immigration flow. The Biden administration has to invest in America's own immigration court system as well, because the backlog is overwhelming. There are 1.3 million cases waiting to be resolved as we speak. There is no way that this logjam can be fixed without more immigration judges and a more streamlined and fair system. It's a dual challenge in the United States and in Central America. It won't be easy, but that's the only way really to help these people who are very objectively suffering.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you about something else. So there's this 100-day deportation moratorium. Biden implemented this during his first days in office. The argument for a moratorium is that it would give the Biden administration time to look at each detainee's case. This week, a federal judge blocked this measure. There are currently 14,000 people in detention centers throughout the country. Leon, what is next on this front?
Oh, that's a difficult question. So many things. I think the immigration system in the United States is fundamentally broken. you can see that, for example, in the conditions that detainees face in these detention facilities that are run by private companies. That has to end. There has to be a solution for that. I personally visited the ICE detention facility in Adelanto, one of the largest ones in the nation here in Southern California. And the conditions are very similar to a jail. And these are people who came to the United States looking for a better life. The immense majority of them are completely peaceful, honest, hardworking people. And to treat them otherwise is just immoral. It's just not worthy of the history of the United States. And the Biden administration has its work cut out for it, fixing what the Trump administration left behind. And deportation is just one aspect. There are many others, and it will take patience and real moral imagination and financial resources as well, and the collaboration of regional governments, I have to add, including and starting with the López Obrador administration in Mexico.
Leon Krause is a Univision host and Washington Post columnist. Thank you so much for this conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you.
A few years ago, my daughter was a big K-pop fanatic, specifically the group BTS. And from the first time I heard them, I thought, this sounds like 90s R&B. BTS is one of the first K-pop groups to blow up here in the United States. And it's no secret how much Black American culture has influenced K-pop music at large. But now these groups are facing a call to action that has come along with embracing American culture, and that's activism. Crystal Anderson has been looking more into this, tracing the many connections between Black American popular music and K-pop. Her book on the subject is called Soul in Seoul, African American Popular Music and K-pop. She's an affiliate Korean studies faculty member at George Mason University. Crystal and I spoke last September, and we're going to revisit that conversation now. We started out talking about how U.S. K-pop fans had mobilized last summer to support Black Lives Matter. They used their massive and collective power on social media to do this. And the company behind BTS, Big Hit, actually responded and donated $1 million to BLM. But they were an outlier in K-pop, and fans wanted more from their K-pop idols. And I asked Crystal about the conflict there.
The conflict is that Korea has its own culture, and more importantly, it has a specific kind of mission for its outward-facing Korean artists, particularly the pop groups. So the pop groups are supposed to have a very positive image of Korea. So it's not new, but what is new is that the United States has a particular kind of history, and it has a particular kind of history in relation to South Korea. So I think going forward, what we're going to see is a different kind of negotiation of that relationship.
This is really interesting, and you lay this out somewhat in your book. Your book also really lays out the influence Black American artists have had on K-pop artists, and it's significant. We'll listen to a bit of those influence in just a moment. But how did this connection between Black American pop and Korean pop even come to be?
Well, it was there at the beginning. Most histories of K-pop, and we're talking about contemporary Korean popular music, and one of the first groups drew on hip-hop and R&B of the 1990s. And so it's really there at the beginning.
Under the huge umbrella of this genre, you note that there are three types of artists: K-pop groups, R&B, and hip-hop. And you selected some songs that are K-pop in various genres, and also some comparisons to popular Black American artists in the U.S. for us to listen to. First, let's listen to your picks in the K-pop groups category. KC and JoJo's All My Life up against 2PM's Wanna Love You Again. I just wanna love you.
Baby, crave for someone like
I mean, hearing them back to back, we really do hear the influence there. Why did you pick these two songs to compare?
I chose these two songs because 2PM is kind of on the sexier end of the spectrum of K-pop idol groups. But what people may not realize is that the group also boasts a very significant bank of vocalists. But going through their discography, I kept coming across these R&B ballads, and they were R&B ballads with no qualification. And I thought that that would be a really great comparison to Casey and JoJo. And so you can hear very clearly those similarities.
And I want to talk to you more. We'll talk in just a moment about that influence, but then how transparent many of these K-pop artists are about who they're influenced by. This next group, though, this is an example of R&B acts in the K-pop genre. And we have Can't Stop Loving You by Korean artist Brown Eyed Soul up against a song by Sly and the Family Stone. Let's listen.
Can't stop loving you. Can't stop loving me. I can't stop loving you. You're the one that dance to the music. Dance to the music. Dance to the music.
Okay, I hear it. What are the commonalities that you hear in these two?
So Brown Eyed Soul is a Korean R&B group, and they've had a changing lineup, but the constant is the founder, and that founder is a musician. And so the great thing about Brown Eyed Soul is that it shows that K-pop doesn't just draw from the contemporary music of its time. It also reaches back to older genres of Black popular music.
You know, a lot of music critics make the distinction between what K-pop is doing here, which you even say is a skill of hybridity, versus what many white artists have done in the past by taking Black American blues music, for instance, and essentially stealing it. Why do you make this distinction?
Well, one thing that we can see in those instances is that often those songs that were initially written and performed by African American artists were covered by white performers to achieve popularity, but those covers were watered down versions of the original, and they were designed to suit the taste of a particular mainstream, and so would describe that mainstream as white. And the Black originators were not given credit. However, what I see in K-pop, and as you said at the beginning, it's hard to miss the R&B influence in K-pop. So I like to use the concept of citation. Much like you cite your sources for a news story or for a research paper, K-pop artists are citing the R&B music tradition, and they're doing so through authentic performances. And Brittany Cooper has used this term to describe this idea in relation to popular music, that the idea is to point the listener back to the original. So it's not a conspiracy and it's not hidden. In addition, K-pop creators have actually worked with African-American artists and producers to create this music, so that also reinforces that connection.
You also picked out some hip-hop artists to compare. We have Korean hip-hop artist Primary with the song 2 Weeks up against The Roots performing The Next Movement. Let's listen. Side note, Crystal, that was my jam back in the day. tell us more about these.
So I chose these two because there's a tradition of live instrumentation in hip-hop. In K-pop, Primary is a Korean musical producer on the hip-hop label Amoeba Culture. And when you listen to Primary's music, there is almost always live instrumentation. He does very little sampling. Just like you have that live instrumentation in The Next Movement, you have the rhythms of R&B, and you have rap all over that as well.
You know, we started off this convo talking about the stark cultural differences that were shown at the start of this country's racial reckoning back earlier in the summer. Do you see a future in which K-pop can sustain a fan base here and become a part of the musical landscape on a deeper level? What are some of the challenges in that effort here in the United States?
I would say some of the challenges are include language. That's the primary challenge. The other challenge, though, is related to the history of the United States and its history with immigration, with Korea as a country, with the racial history in the United States itself, that colors the way that people perceive the cultural production of other countries. But I have often argued, if you look at other kinds of cultural production in the United States that are popular with subgroups, those are sustained in a far longer kind of way. One of my favorites is kung fu films, martial arts films from China, and samurai films from Japan to a certain extent, or something like anime. These are things that live in subcultures, but they are significant. So I think that you'll always have a subculture that's interested in K-pop, just like you have a subculture that's interested in Bollywood, in anime, in Chinese martial arts films. But the degree to which they infiltrate the mainstream, I think we just still have to see whether that's going to be sustained.
Crystal Anderson is the author of the new book, Soul in Seoul, African American Popular Music and K-pop. Crystal, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
We just listened back to my conversation with K-pop scholar Crystal Anderson from September.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
If you're never quite sure how to answer the question,
where are you from?
NPR's Rough Translation might be the podcast for you.
Yes, finally, someone else.
Give us your accents and your origin stories, your cross-cultural misfits, yearning to just be, and listen to Rough Translation on NPR.
Let's take a moment to try to make sense of what's happening on Wall Street. Shares of the video game retailer GameStop continue their roller coaster ride today after shooting up 1,700% at one point this month. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News, who's been following this story. And Mike, at one point this morning, things got so volatile that trading in GameStop came to a stop. What's going on?
All right, Peter. So there are things known as circuit breakers in the market. And basically what happens is trading is paused for a few minutes if a stock jumps or plunges a big amount in a short period of time. It's actually happened with GameStop a lot in recent weeks, maybe several times a day. Today, obviously, though, the big difference is the stock was down a lot, as much as almost 68% at one point. And a big reason for that is that some brokerages, Robinhood, for example, have put restrictions on trading of not only GameStop, but about a dozen other companies that have been having similar crazy moves in the stock market. And it's really led to a lot of backlash. For example, Ted Cruz and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez actually agreeing with each other that Robinhood shouldn't have done this because it's preventing people from trading the way the pros would, because they are, you know, professional investors are still allowed to buy and sell these stocks where these discount brokerages are putting restrictions on.
Okay, let's take a step back and try to explain exactly what's at the heart of all of this. Shorting a stock, right, Mike? Explain.
Right. So a short sale is basically a bet that the price of a stock will go down. And the way it works is if I'm a short seller, I will borrow shares from my brokerage and then quickly sell them, say for $10 a share. And if I'm right and the price drops to, say, $5 a share, then I can buy them back and repay that loan to my brokerage. And I keep that $5 difference, obviously multiplied by however many shares were involved. What happens if a company is very heavily shorted? In other words, there's a lot of investors doing this. Then it's vulnerable to what's called a short squeeze, because if the stock actually goes up, all these bearish investors betting on a drop are going to want to get out of that trade and buy the stock. So it really propels the stock higher very quickly and very high.
And that happened because a bunch of amateur investors got together on a popular message board, Reddit. What was their motivation? And was all of this somehow organized?
Yeah, I think the motivation obviously is to make some money. There are some describing it as sort of a David versus Goliath parable of wealth inequality. And maybe there's some truth to that on some level. But obviously, you get into trading stocks to make money. And it was coordinated on Reddit and some other social media sites where someone says, hey, look, this stock is vulnerable to a short squeeze. And there's other strategies that involve the options market that are a little more complicated. But then others sort of go, you know, you're right. And they all start buying the stock. And this is what it leads to.
30 seconds here, Mike. But what are the legal implications? I know the SEC is keeping an eye on this.
Yeah, I think it's tricky for regulators, Peter, because, you know, they may find a few incidents of illegal behavior. But most of what I described is not really illegal. So it's a tricky one for them.
All right. Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. I think we're going to be keeping an eye on this story over the next couple of days. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
At this point in the pandemic, you may be eager to get vaccinated so that your life can return to some kind of normal. But most of us still have to wait because the elderly and people at high risk are at the front of the line. Still, there are stories about people trying to skip ahead or just coincidentally being in the right place at the right time when a shot becomes available. In Oregon, healthcare workers stuck in snarled traffic went car to car, giving out doses before they expired. So what are the moral questions we should all be thinking about right now? Art Kaplan is Director of Medical Ethics at the NYU School of Medicine. Art, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. So from the point of view of a medical ethicist, how do you judge the way vaccine rollout and distribution has gone so far?
I would say somewhere between miserable, awful, and what my grandmother would have called fakakta, meaning all screwed up. It's been bad. Very, very bad.
Why?
Well, first of all, the Trump administration sort of promised that they'd have a surplus of vaccines, right? Remember, we were all saying there's going to be extra vaccine and we'll roll it out. And states began to plan for it. And then Biden showed up and there was no surplus. There was nothing. They said they distributed everything. That left us wondering, well, how much vaccine is there? A question to which we still don't have an answer. We don't know how much we've got. And that's terrible.
Yeah. And it does create some ethical questions here, doesn't it? Because so many people want this vaccine. And because of the supply issues, not everybody can get it. So let's walk through some of the tricky issues it has brought up. Number one, people of color have been disproportionately hit by this pandemic. Should race be taken into account when determining vaccine priority?
Yeah, well, I think race absolutely correlates with risk of getting COVID and danger then of getting hospitalized or dying. But I think what correlates also is race, poverty, and exposure. So if you're a wealthy person who's a minority, say black, living out in the burbs, I'm not sure your race puts you at any increased risk. There's no evidence that somehow biologically any group or subgroup is more in danger. What makes you in danger is if you have a job as a bus driver or cleaning rooms, which tend to go to, in many places, poor African Americans. And if you have chronic health conditions because you didn't get good health care out of our health system, so there's more diabetes or hypertension or asthma, that puts you at risk. So I think while we tend to want to focus just on race, what we should be paying attention to is the horrible secret of American health care that if you're poor and a minority and have a job that exposes you to the virus more than most people, that's where the risk is.
Related to that, prisoners, that has emerged as a pretty tricky issue, politically speaking, at least. Where should prisoners be in line?
first in line, and I know it's a tough political issue. Some states have said, forget it, we're not doing prisoners. Some states have even said, kind of dumb policy, we'll do the guards, but not the prisoners, which doesn't make any sense because you got other people coming in and out, visitors, administrators, people bringing food and so on. Look, prisons, we know, are incubators of COVID. It's hard to socially distance. It's hard to stay safe there. They're not hygienic to begin with. You always have a roommate in nearly every prison. Jails, you get a lot of people who are cramped together too. Plus, I might point out, in jails, a lot of the people aren't even convicted of anything. They're just there waiting on bail, waiting for a trial.
So prisoners are not getting vaccinated at any great rate, but politicians are. Many have gotten doses before everybody else, and the argument is that they need to project confidence in the vaccine so that others will trust taking it, and they have to protect the continuity of government. What do you think about that? Should able-bodied politicians be offering themselves up first?
Yeah. Do you have that kind of bleeping sound you can make when I start swearing about this? Do you have that available? This is the stupidest argument I've ever heard. Meaning, there isn't enough vaccine out there anyway. So what are we building confidence in if you can't get a vaccine? I mean, it's silly. It's too early to be doing that. Also, who trusts a politician? I don't see any change in vaccine confidence and vaccine refusals as a result of this burst of politicians pushing up to the head of the line. So I think it was unethical to do that right now. If you wanted to show support for vaccines, go to a nursing home and applaud while they vaccinate the residents.
Mm. You know, it's not just politicians either who are looking to skip the line. For example, where I live in Arizona, young people might go along in the car with an older relative at a drive-through vaccination center because the site will sometimes give out shots to anyone who's inside, regardless of age or health. What do you think about something like that? If you're offered a shot, is it ethical to take one?
Well, I'm going to say this. If somebody offers you a shot, you should take it. I'm presuming they're offering it because they don't know what else to do. They're going to throw it away or it's going to go to waste. Wasting vaccine in the middle of a plague is not a good idea. So I think you can take it. You may say, is there anyone else around who's more in need of this than I am that we could give it to? That's a legitimate and ethical question. But assuming the person with the vaccine says, no, it's either you or it goes in the trash or I don't know what to do with it, then take it. So that would be my recommendation there.
But isn't there a difference between actively putting yourself in a position, say getting in a car with an older relative because maybe you'll get a shot, and just having it be a coincidence or luck that somebody offers you a shot because you happen to be in the pharmacy and there's a PA announcement that says, hey, we've got an extra shot here, come on down and get one?
Well, look, on a scale of morally bad, the worst thing to do is to bribe your way to a shot, which some people have tried to do, and I think in a few parts of the country have succeeded. Some people have flown to places, Florida, the Yukon, in the case of a Canadian billionaire couple who flew up and managed to get vaccinated along with a bunch of poor Inuit people in a rural Yukon site. Those are horrible things to do. You're cutting the line. You're using your resources to cheat. If you got to drive your grandma, somebody's got to take her, and you're in the car anyway, I don't know that you're – I mean, you may have a hope that maybe you'll get lucky and you'll get vaccinated too, but you still have to take grandma there. So I wouldn't put that quite on a par with finagling your way to get a shot through resources. And then there's the person who's just hanging around the nursing home, working there. They're not quite in the high-risk group, but they say, you know, come on, we got to do something with this excess vaccine. So there's a scale, if you will, of moral propriety. I think the people who bribe their way to vaccination, that's the worst thing you can do when you're pushing aside others who are needier.
Sure. The thing is, though, we are in such uncharted territory. No one's ever gone through something like this before, have we? I mean, and would we even have to consider the ethics if there was a more cohesive national distribution plan in place? I mean, really, is it our fault that the government hasn't figured this out?
Yeah, partly it's our fault. We did not demand of our politicians, whether it's the Trump administration as they got ready, or local officials, state officials, to tell us what is the plan, how will it be implemented, what are the logistics. Here's something that drives me crazy as a simple thing. A lot of states rely on you using the internet and making appointments, right, to get a vaccine. And their websites crash. And oftentimes they say there's no appointment. Try us again in 24 hours. Refresh. Come back in 6 hours. The people who are trying to get in there are often 75 years old and older. They're not many of them are not savvy to that. A state should be in charge of offering you appointment times, not putting the burden the other way. So I think areas like that show how we really failed to handle the needs of the vulnerable and the most at risk. In this case, the elderly, who I think are least likely to be able to manipulate the internet, and the poor elderly are probably least likely to have the internet. So yeah, I think there's a lot of culpability here, not being prepared, not being ready. You asked, you know, do we ever do this? I've worked for many decades in transplant. Transplants are rationed every day. We don't have enough organs. We have to pick people to get them. We have a system. It works fairly well. People die who don't get a transplant, but they know what the rules are, and people follow the rules. The rules get enforced. It's not like we never rationed anything in this country. But when it came to vaccines, we just seemed to, well, look, President Trump didn't talk about COVID or vaccines for the last 2 or 3 months of his administration, right? We weren't prepping. We were just talking about rigged elections.
Art Kaplan, director of the Medical Ethics Division at the NYU School of Medicine, helping us navigate the ethics of vaccine distribution. Art, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You might have noticed that the vibrant yellow spice turmeric has been popping up in a number of unexpected places lately, in tea, lattes, even smoothies. We're joined now by Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst, who has been exploring the uses of the spice, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, Tanya.
Hey, Kathy. So why is turmeric suddenly so popular?
Well, there are a bunch of reasons. I mean, first, there's the color, as you mentioned, that brilliant marigold orange color. It's got this floral, warming, slightly musky taste, and it's one of the primary flavors in Indian and Southeast Asian cooking. It's also what gives curry powder its bright yellow color, and it's been used as a spice and a medicinal herb in India for thousands of years. But as you mentioned, it has recently become the darling of the food world.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny how spices, how that happens. You know, there's a spice of the year that happens.
Well, exactly.
Well, you've actually you have some dishes that have been inspired by Indian dishes that use this spice. Tell us a little bit about them.
Well, I spent the past few weeks really playing around in the kitchen with turmeric, and I found there are very few things that it doesn't add a great flavor to. I started with a fairly traditional Indian dish, a turmeric spiced dal, dal or Indian lentils, and I used turmeric in two ways in this dish. The lentils are simmered with water and dry turmeric, and then once they're soft, while they're cooking, I sauteed a mixture of turmeric and cumin seeds and cinnamon and chili pepper in ghee, which is clarified butter or vegetable oil, and then add fresh ginger and onions and tomatoes and cilantro and swirl that spicy red topping into the dal. And it is a beautiful, warming winter dish.
Kathy, I always feel like maybe I actually love cooking when I hear you talk about cooking. You also have this dish that uses roasted vegetables. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, this is a slight variation on a traditional curry. You take cauliflower and carrots and sweet potato. Again, vibrant colors in the winter. You roast them first to give it a beautiful golden brown. And then you spice some coconut milk with turmeric and cumin seed and fennel seed and cinnamon. And then you put the roasted vegetables right into this beautifully spiced coconut milk. And it makes a gorgeous stew that you serve over basmati rice. You can sprinkle it with cilantro. Very quick and simple, actually.
Okay. I mean, okay, before we go any further with another recipe that you have, we should mention, as you said, it stains and it is hard or almost impossible to get out.
You want to be really careful. I had a wonderful conversation with DJ Reka, a New York City-based DJ and cultural producer of Southeast Asian descent. And we talked a lot about staining of turmeric, but she also talked about how it kind of infuriates her to see turmeric held up as this elixir, this cure-all to everything. Mm. She said when she was growing up, it was in the masala spice box right next to salt and pepper. It was sort of a marker of identity. And it was a totally ordinary thing to cook with, just like salt.
Yep. I believe that. Okay. So you have, you've given us several savory flavored dishes. You actually have a cake as well that uses the spice.
Yeah, turmeric is used in desserts and sweet dishes, often in combination with yogurt. I made a turmeric and ginger blood orange cake. It's a cake that's made in a regular old loaf pan. If you can find blood oranges, which are in season right now,
it's a stunning
color. Yep. Or just regular oranges. And this cake uses yogurt. So it's quite good for you. And then you can serve it for breakfast with yogurt. You can eat it for dessert. The color and the flavor of this cake is so extraordinary. I can't stop eating it. It's just wonderful. Mm.
Oh my gosh, we'll have pictures and also the recipe on our website. Before we let you go, tell us some other recipes that we can use this spice for.
Well, I talked to a woman named Sana Javeri Kadri, who owns a company called Diaspora Co., and they sell probably the best turmeric I've ever tasted. And she likes to add a pinch of turmeric with a crack of black pepper and a knob of butter to a pot of rice. Very simple. You can add turmeric to chicken skin before roasting it. Same with fish fillets when you're roasting vegetables. Generally, Nick Sharma, a cookbook author, pointed out to me that you almost always want to be cooking it. It's kind of harsh when it's raw. So generally it's sauteed in a little bit of oil with other spices to release that beautiful flavor and toast the spices. And then it's added to curries and soups and stews. But there's a lot of experimenting you can do with this spice.
We've been talking about turmeric with Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst. For recipes and tips, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. As always, thank you so much, Kathy.
Thank you, Tanya.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.